From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, a new study showcases the role so-called small batch manufacturing has on the local business climate.
And we're seeing these more and more in cities because manufacturing, as times have changed, has shrunk, whether it's due to technology, whether it's due to space constraints. So we're really excited to sort of see what this data says about these new manufacturers.
Then why the son of the late Kenyan photojournalist Mohamed Amin chose Milwaukee's Chip Duncan to curate the world's first exhibit of his late father's work.
I wouldn't have trusted anyone else with them to curate them and to work on them, cropping them and touching them up and changing them in some ways, improving them, enhancing them. I know where his mind is at, and it's exactly what I think my father would have wanted.
Plus, we'll have the latest in our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tike. Construction is underway in Racine County on the first elements of Foxconn's massive factory complex. Plans call for the factory to employ thousands of workers who will, at first, assemble television sets, but later are expected to build high-tech glass screens for electronic devices.
The Foxconn development elicited an unprecedented state incentive package, with advocates saying it has the potential to transform the economy of the region. But a new report out says another part of the manufacturing sector is already having a transformative effect.
Katie Stanton is the program manager for the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, which authored the State of Urban Manufacturing Report. Marcus White is vice president of civic engagement for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having us, Mitch.
So what's the significance of what you would term small batch manufacturing, and why do you think it is so important to quantify the data surrounding it?
The State of Urban Manufacturing Report is a research project that the Urban Manufacturing Alliance has spearheaded in six different cities because we really wanted to understand what manufacturing looks like today. You know, folks still have a perception of manufacturing being big, dirty, repetitive, boring, and we just don't think that that's the case anymore. But we really wanted to dig in and understand what these new kind of manufacturers looked like. And so we were able to go into these six different cities, of which Milwaukee was one, work with community partners to really understand first the landscape of manufacturing in Milwaukee, and then dig into these small companies, not only their workforce demographics, but their barriers to scale, what their hopes for growth was, how they define themselves. And so now we're really looking at this new kind of manufacturer, what you reference as small batch producers. And we're seeing these more and more in cities because manufacturing, as times have changed, has shrunk, whether it's due to technology, whether it's due to space constraints. So we're really excited to sort of see what this data says about these new manufacturers.
Why was Milwaukee one of the, you know, you said there were six cities where you did this deep dive, as the kids say these days. Why was Milwaukee an important one to include in this study?
Well, a lot of the cities that we included were in the heartland. You know, Milwaukee, just like many other cities like Detroit and Cincinnati, Baltimore, have sort of been ravaged by outsourcing, or offshoring. There
yes.
You go. It was a combination. And so Milwaukee provided a really good opportunity to take a look at what was once such a powerhouse and really still is. There's so much manufacturing still located here. But we also have a lot of our network is based in Milwaukee. We have some really strong partners, not only the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and our other sponsor, Bader Philanthropies, but folks in the industrial bid community, workforce nonprofits. So we really saw an opportunity to leverage our network here, and then also because of the historical context.
What's in it for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation to get this kind of data?
Well, I think similar to what Katie just described, that just given this region's legacy, I think that's what appealed to us at the Greater Milwaukee Foundation and to Bader Philanthropies to support this work, to be part of this national cohort. But we know manufacturing is still a strength here. It's one of our largest sectors for employment still in this region, and we're a national leader in that. One question we often ask is the manufacturing a strength upon which we should continue to build, or is it industry of the past that we're too dependent on? I don't know that there's an answer to that yet, But what we saw in this study is that there is indeed manufacturing happening in different ways, sometimes in smaller ways, but a lot of larger manufacturers are part of this study too. We saw what I think a lot of people see, that there is this growing maker movement, a movement that's been here for some time. And I think we've all just sort of noticed its growth. And when you have community events and things like Night Market that Milwaukee puts on, and you see all of these local artisans, artists, and others, tells you something is brewing. And so when we had the opportunity to support this and be part of it, we were very enthusiastic to understand what is going on. How big is this sector? Is it an area that has potential for significant economic development in our region? And what do we all need to do to support that?
So is this in the Venn diagram of economic sectors, is this the overlap between the creative economy and the manufacturing industry?
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely say that. We ask a question in this study about how the respondents defined themselves over time at founding, and then when they took the survey, and answers ranged from artisan to maker to manufacturer to business person. And it was really interesting to see how those shifted and changed, particularly as companies grew. So at founding, folks might consider themselves a maker. 2 to 6 years later, they consider themselves a business person. And not only does that sort of speak to your intersection, the Venn diagram, but it also speaks to how organizations, whether in city government or nonprofit or community-based organizations, need to sort of understand to help these companies grow and for them to become economic development drivers.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are obviously a lot of economic analyses of the various sectors of the workforce, the various sectors of the economy. Is this a case of, you know, an industry kind of sneaking up on us, and there's just not a lot of data that's been out there that's quantified the impact yet?
I would say so. So, you know, studies often rely on national level data, maybe Bureau of Labor Statistics or NAICS codes. And again, what we were trying to get at is those folks who don't necessarily fit into that definition, maybe because they're so small that they're missed by those surveys, or maybe because their processes are new and innovative and, again, don't fit into those general NAICS codes. So,
I mean, is it a trick when some of them just don't self-identify as manufacturers?
That could be part of it, certainly. Or perhaps they're just one person, and mm-hmm. so they really slip under the radar.
Well, I think also that there's been this growth due to just the changes in commerce. And, for instance, one of the national sponsors of this work is Etsy. And, for instance, I just purchased a steel sign from a maker in California through Etsy. And just in recent years, I think we've all become accustomed to that, and it has changed, I think, the potential for artists, for makers. They are becoming businesses or manufacturers in some case, but I think the changes in commerce have allowed that kind of growth. And again, for us locally, what's the role for all of us to play in supporting that growth so that, for instance, mm-hmm. I don't continue buying signs from a guy in California?
Right. And I think there's implications there. You know, some folks who are small batch producers or makers or however they identify themselves won't want to grow. And they're mm-hmm. a very valuable part of the ecosystem. But those folks who are perhaps looking to grow, and in Milwaukee, about 94% of the respondents are looking to grow, we really have to help service providers and technical assistance providers understand how those people need support and what they need in order so that Marcus can buy a sign in Milwaukee and the company who makes it can hire their next 2 to 5 to 10 employees.
Well, so we've kind of been talking about this from the, you know, from the aerial view here, but let's talk about it from an on the ground sort of standpoint. What are some of the numbers that might jump out at people about, you know, both the numbers of people in this sector and the economic impact that they have?
So our study was a snapshot of in time. We surveyed about 100 makers and manufacturers across the city of all sizes. And I think two things really stood out to me. First, the statistic I already listed, which 94% anticipate to be either significantly or slightly larger than they are now. I can't give you a total number of what that would be, but let's say every one of them wanted 2 to 10 employees. That's 200 to 1,000 employees. Mm-hmm. If we're able to support them in the right way, and that is certainly would have an effect on our neighborhoods. I think the other statistic that I'll say is that 94% of our respondents relied on personal investment to start their company, to grow their company. And that has a lot of implications for growth, but also for equity. You know, we're looking at communities. I should say that manufacturing is still, we believe, a pathway out to the middle class and out of poverty. It pays living wages. It is family sustaining. But if folks are not, if they're not part of a wealthy network and they can't even start their business, how are they supposed to create jobs that can help lift others out of poverty? And so we really encourage, that was an encouraging finding, or an interesting finding, I should say, that we want to encourage people to look deeper into.
Well, and of course, we hear a lot about the kinds of incentive packages that large manufacturing companies receive in efforts to lure them here. I won't name any by name, except people are obviously thinking of the word Foxconn. Mm-hmm. But what sorts of supports, as you dug into this data, what sorts of supports do you think or were the people that you spoke with saying would really make the difference to these smaller entrepreneurs?
Well, to keep banging on the same drum, access to sort of flexible financing. So rather than your traditional bank loans that require a lot of capital, really trying to look for creative partnerships between philanthropy, nonprofits, city government, other lenders, in order to give these businesses the sort of flexible capital. And I know the city of Milwaukee has a very successful partnership with Kiva, which is very encouraging and exciting to have learned about. And we're seeing that in a number of different cities. But thinking about how to expand that and to help, you know, get folks beyond the 5 to 10,000 range and between the 50 and 500,000 range.
In terms of their sales?
In terms of, sure, sales, but more so the amount of loan that they would need.
I see. Yeah.
Right. And so is there a public policy implication for this? Is this, you know, creating a climate where that sort of thing is more readily available?
Well, I think there's great opportunity there. And Mitch, there's two things I want to do. There's four things stuck out for me about the challenges that business owners and makers are feeling. And then there's the contextual piece too, in this particular to this region. So as Katie said, financing is one of those. Access to capital was a theme in this report. Finding new customers was a theme. The need for employees, and that may get even more difficult. And space. And I think all of those things, capital, finding new customers, employees, and space are the types of things where local government, state government, philanthropy, nonprofit sector, chambers of commerce, and other business owners can all collaborate to help promote those locally produced goods and find those new customers, to come up with new, more patient financing models. Obviously, we're willing to do that, whether it's a large screen manufacturer or a giant facility for professional sports. We have a commitment here to putting public dollars into those. And we're certainly not going to argue that that's a bad strategy. The report actually acknowledges that indeed local communities still need to go after large employers. That's always going to be part of the mix. But what else can you do to begin building wealth and, frankly, creating ways for innovation and creativity to become a business? This community, with its history of manufacturing, is a community that innovates. It's what we've been like for a long, long time. And what we see here is that on a smaller scale, that spirit, that sort of Milwaukee's spirit of being the workshop to the world, continues. So as a matter of policy, what can we all do to support those things? In the contextual piece, Kate talked about equity. We're in a region right now, our 4-county metro area is 1/3 people of color. When you look at people under age 25 in our 4-county region, it's 45% people of color. And preschoolers in our 4-county region are now majority people of color. Our region's future is tied to communities of color. And one thing we heard in the study is that people of color who are trying to make a go of it didn't feel like they had the same kind of access to financing and capital. And that's something we have to be very intentional about, because we can build this region to be one where everyone thrives. And I think that's going to be part of the mix. How can we be more intentional about the kind of tools that are needed and who can access those tools?
At this stage, with the data that you've now seen, do you come out of it with some level of optimism about what is possible?
For sure. The report to me was far more encouraging than I was expecting. I was expecting, I think, I might have hypothesized that we'd hear a lot about struggle. And that's in there, but there is far more optimism and hope. So to me, that's what's really exciting, that it's even more vibrant of a sector than I might have anticipated. So I think there is great potential there in all kinds of ways. And one of the things the report mentions is perhaps unlike some of the cities that Katie just cited, we don't have what the report refers to as someone at the helm. And that might be a next step for our region for a public-private partnership. We need someone at the helm who can pull together these things, who can say, if we're going to invest in these types of things, these are also worth investment. And so I think that's a next step for us. But it is an exciting time. And again, I had mentioned before that there are all kinds of places we all bump into events with local manufacturers. And so I think everybody knows that there's something cool going on. How can we support it and grow it?
Well, thank you so much for sharing this report with us and getting us thinking about it as well.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Mitch.
Marcus White is Vice President of Civic Engagement for the Greater Milwaukee Foundation. Katie Stanton is the Program Manager for the Urban Manufacturing Alliance, which authored the State of Urban Manufacturing Report. You'll find a link to it at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll talk with the creators of a new photography exhibit on view at the Charles Allis Museum. Lake Effect Weekend returns on WUWM.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. It is hard to overstate what a prolific photojournalist Mohamed Amin was in his relatively short life. When the Kenyan native died in 1996, he left behind 2.5 million still photographs and more than 5,000 hours of raw video shot over 33 years. Until now, almost none of that work has been displayed in the United States.
The first exhibit of his work in the world is now open at Milwaukee's Charles Allis Museum. It was curated by Amin's son, Salim, and Milwaukee photojournalist and filmmaker Chip Duncan, whose work is also part of the exhibit. Amin and Duncan were in town last week to open the exhibit and visited us in the studio then. Amin explained how their friendship and collaboration began.
I made a documentary on my father's life in 2006 called Mo and Me, which was Al Jazeera's launch documentary for their English language channel. And one of the people I interviewed for that was Harry Belafonte, who was in the film. So when I launched it in New York at the New York Film Festival, I went to see Harry just to give him a copy of the film to say thank you and for him to see it. I then went to Los Angeles for the LA Film Festival from New York, and Harry called me up and said, you know, I've just watched the documentary and, you know, this should be made into a feature film. So I was like, well, that's very kind of you, but I don't know anything about making feature films. That's not my line of work. And he was like, well, leave it with me. And a few hours later, I got a call from Danny Glover, who,
as you do,
as one does,
yes.
Who said, look, Harry has asked me to, you know, have a look at your documentary and I need to see it. And I sent him a copy and we kept corresponding with him and his business partner. And they said, right, fine, we'll buy the rights for your father's story. We want the rights. And the next stage would be to get a writer to Nairobi to start doing the research and to start spending some time with you. And lo and behold, a couple of months later, Mr. Duncan shows up at my house in Nairobi, and that's where our friendship started. The feature film hasn't been made yet. It's still in the works. But our friendship started from there, and we ended up doing tons of new projects and documentaries together. That's
still
my version, so I'm not sure what yours is.
What's yours, Chip? Is that about
actually
the same?
It's pretty close. I knew Danny as well, and Danny and his business partner, Jocelyn Barnes, saw some similarities between the way I approach my craft and the way that Mo approached his, and I'm also a writer. So whether I cross the finish line as the writer is yet to be determined, but regardless, my photographic style and my documentary style were very similar to Mo's. And so the more I got into the archives, started curating Mo's work, and then eventually editing some of his work for publication, it just made sense for us to try and bring a show together that featured both of us. Now, sadly, Mo passed away in 1996, so while he's not a part of it, we're really lucky at the Charles Alice Museum to have Salim Amin. And, you know, his presence in the exhibition is well noted.
You mentioned that, or it was mentioned in the articles that I was reading, that you never have an opportunity to actually meet. But do you feel that you have, in a way, becoming friends with Salim?
From everything I have learned about Mo, Salim is a much nicer guy.
Is that true?
Very true, I think. Okay. I think I'm far nicer.
And but, in terms of going out to dinner, I think I'm with the right one. But having said that, Mo was prolific. And really, he started with a camera at a very early age and was publishing images by the time he was 13, and carried his career much longer and much further than most photojournalists ever do, even though he died at a very young age. He built one of the largest archives on earth of independent content. And so I feel like I got to know him. I've interviewed everybody in his world, from his wife to one of his traveling companions, to several of his colleagues, his son. I do feel like I got to know him very well.
And I think that actually they would have got on really, really well. I see so many similarities between Chip's work and my father's work, between their work ethic, because I've been in the field with both of them, how they operate in the field and how they create these relationships with the people they photograph. And, you know, when people come and see the pictures that Chip has shot and the relationship he has with the subjects, you can only get that if you are truly spectacular at your work and create this bond that allows people to be very comfortable around you when you're photographing them. That, to me, is the biggest asset that a photojournalist has, is when they can make their subject feel so comfortable that they are, you know, revealing themselves to you, and it comes out in the photographs. The joy, the tears, the laughter, it's all there. And I just feel that was the uniqueness of both of their work. And when you see them side by side, I think they would have been great friends. My dad might have tried to, you know, shaft him in business or something at some point. But other than that, I think they would have been great friends.
So you think the images and the way of looking at the world speak to each other? They have a relationship on the wall?
Absolutely. You know, when I look at the pictures together, while they're different eras, I think the art and the connection between the subject and the photographer are quite similar and unique. And just by watching both of them in the field and operating them, I wouldn't have trusted anybody else with my dad's images, because they're obviously very special to me. But I wouldn't have trusted anyone else with them to curate them and to work on them, cropping them and touching them up and you know, changing them in some ways, improving them, enhancing them. But, you know, I know where his mind is at, and it's exactly what I think my father would have wanted. And he was very private with his work. This is the first time ever that his work has been exhibited, the body of his work has been exhibited anywhere in the world, because he was very private about it. He shot pictures for himself.
Do you think that this could have happened were he still alive?
I don't know. It's a very good question, Bonnie. I don't know if it would have happened, because, like I said, for him, it wasn't about making money. It wasn't about selling prints. It was a very personal thing to him. So I'm not sure it would have happened.
He did publish extensively, and he was a preeminent storyteller who used the camera as his toolbox. And so he shot motion and he shot stills, and he had a personality that was global. Frequently, you'll hear people who say, "Well, you know, that based on whatever your ethnicity is, you might limit yourself to photographing other people who are like you." Neither he nor I have ever done that. And so Mo was comfortable going into any community. He could work in Pakistan, anywhere in East Africa. He could work in South America. It didn't really matter, because his personality somehow was such that he gained people's trust.
So what do you think differentiates what you do, Chip, and what Mo did from, say, a portrait photographer? How does this become photojournalism?
Well, I would say, I mean, in terms of my father's work, there are very few photographers that are as versatile as he was. So he shot everything from, you know, frontline war and famine and genocide and dictators, so news, hard news, as well as wildlife and flora and fauna and people and cultures and mountains and beaches. So he did everything, which not many photographers do. Chip is also in that same category. Not many photographers can be versatile. They specialize in a particular type of photography, reportage or portraiture or whatever it might be. And it's, I thought it was very unique of both of their styles that they could do all these different types of images. And for me, what was always surprised me and pleasantly surprised me in some ways, irritated me in many ways. I used to go to the game parks with him. So we'd go, you know, to the national parks on the weekends. And he would, you know, find a pride of lions and he would sit with this pride for like 9 hours waiting for them to do something. You know, waiting for that perfect picture for the lion to open their mouth to go and go for a kill, play with the cubs. For me, it was really difficult to relate this man to the hustler who was frantic in the field when it was a frontline situation, but you know, who needed to get that image in a high tension, high impact situation, and someone who could sit for 6 or 7 or 8 hours waiting for a lion or an elephant or somebody to do something interesting. That to me was a passion. And Chip's like that as well. They're very patient. You know, these days when we go out, you know, in the field together, I just tell him, listen, you take the pictures. I'm just going to, you know, I'm chilling. You know, you've got it, I've got it, whatever, you know. They're both the same. I don't feel like carrying cameras around and going there. But he'll spend hours sitting, talking to somebody, you know, getting them comfortable, and then taking the photograph afterwards.
I started my career in TV news as a TV news photographer, and there's a hurry up and wait quality to it. But you learn... You learn a lot of the same skills that a portrait photographer would apply to their work. But for the most part, I'm not comfortable in a studio environment. I'm comfortable outdoors with natural light and the chaos of the world around me. So Mo clearly was as well. In my documentary work, obviously, I have to do a certain amount of studio and lighting type work as well. And he would do that. I mean, Mo shot Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous at one point. I mean, he did.
Did he really?
Yeah, with Robin Leach, if you remember that show.
Do.
Yeah. So he did Brooke Shields in Kenya. That was where that episode was shot. And she signed a photograph of the crew all together and said, you know, dear Mohammed, it was fun working with you. Dangerous, but fun. He was very comfortable, whether it was princes or paupers.
Or lions,
he was very comfortable in every environment. You know, it didn't matter to him. For him, the passion was in taking the photos.
So besides introducing the rest of the world to your father's legacy, what do you hope that people are going to take away from this combined exhibit? And that's a question for both of you.
I hope that people can get a much better understanding of how the camera can be used as a tool of journalism and storytelling. And in a world where we are constantly bombarded with what is now the new term fake news or alternative facts or some of these ridiculous concepts, that the camera doesn't lie. And so, you know, whatever you're seeing, whether it's a Mo Amin photograph of Bobby Kennedy or one of my Maasai images, whatever it is, neither one of us set up our shots. They are the truth as we saw it in that instant. And so anytime we can promote photojournalism as a tool for the truth, I think it's a good way to go about it. And I think that's probably my greatest hope is, you know, bridge building, looking at how one culture is similar to another and how ultimately as humans we really are all pretty much the same. Those are big themes that I think come out of the show.
Well, you know, you said the camera doesn't lie, and I would agree with you, but people do. And I think the fear a lot of people have now is that the images are altered because it's so easy to do that, particularly with digital images.
Well, and to speak to that point, I have a new book that comes out along with the show called Inspiring Change. And I do not do any cropping with my images. I do not eliminate anything from the shot or add anything to the shot. I use traditional darkroom techniques, and that's it. Now, Salim mentioned that I've edited Mo's work, and I have, but all I'm trying to do with the editing of Mo's work is to essentially put it in a fashion that allows it to be printed in a contemporary way. So to give you a sense of what I mean, Mo was shooting mostly slides or negatives. I'm shooting almost entirely digital. So you know, what goes into the computer is different. And so we've had, in some cases, the opportunity to scan the slides ourselves. In others, we're working with slides from the CameraPix archive that have already been scanned. But some of the images have been damaged over time. Some of the images have lost the native color that you would expect to see.
So that's
in
more
an old
restoration.
Kodachrome.
You're talking more restoration.
It really is more restoration. But I had to develop, with the color images in particular, when I look at Mo's color images, I had to make some choices about the way color's interpreted in those images. Whether Mo would like it, I don't know. I'm confident that Salim is on board. But for example, how an image is saturated or what level of vibrancy I might use to bring out what I think was probably in that original Kodachrome 64 slide from 1978, that's more or less the editing that we're talking about. So I might enhance some black levels. I might take the brightness down, add some contrast, that sort of thing, which I would do with my own images. In Mo's, I'm also developing a color palette.
And you think it's fair, what you've seen?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, some of these images are 50, 40, 50, 60 years old. So they have been damaged over time, some of them. The colors have faded because of the state of the film. You know, Chip has never changed the meaning of the photographs. And for any of us, either him or I, it's difficult for us to know what that meaning was supposed to be because neither of us were there when these pictures were taken. But knowing my father's work, I know exactly what he was thinking. And for me, to what I want out of this exhibition, and hopefully there will be many more that we will do, because we have, you know, 2.5 to 3 million images. And this is a small, very small number that we've shown. One is to reintroduce the continent and the history of the continent to the rest of the world, because I think there is a lot of misconceptions about Africa that are still there. And these images hopefully will help people understand the continent and where we've come from and where we're going a little bit better. I've always felt that if you don't know your history, then you can never move forward. So not just for Africans, but for people around the world. I take the Black Panther analogy out of it, that the Wakandas, we had kingdoms long before Western civilization came along. The Ethiopians had these wonderful kingdoms that were there, very advanced kingdoms. We built the pyramids, without any help from people from the West. So, you know, there is an enormous amount of amazing history that has come out of Africa. And I hope this will be something that we can bring out in these photographs and hopefully use them as an educational tool as well within schools, universities. That's also part of the project that we're trying to do, is to not just display the stuff, but get the support to be able to put all this content into primary schools and high schools and universities around the world, where people can actually understand some of the great things about the continent.
So this is the first step.
Yes, definitely. It's the first step, and it's taken us a long time to get here as well. And it's not easy finding the support for that. And I'm hoping that once we get it out there and people actually see it, it's easier to sell, you know, an actual exhibition as an idea where people can physically see what's there rather than just a concept or a document. So we're hoping that will lead into bigger and better things. And, you know, we still haven't given up on working on the feature film. There's very few human interest stories like that I've come along. And I think it would make compelling television or a compelling film. And if that happens, then that takes this content and the value of this content and it'll expose it and open up people's eyes as to the kind of material that he shot.
And who he was
as well. Yeah. Because he was a brave man. I mean, he was, you know, in terms of where journalists go and what they do, he was amongst, you know, the best ever. And for a kid that was born in a slum in Nairobi with no education to become one of the best in the world at what he did, that's something that everyone can emulate. And that was one of the things that he taught me, is that it doesn't matter where you come from. If you have the passion, you can do anything you want.
You know, I'd like to mention that we do a lot of archive work. And your point about restoration with the images, I think, is well taken. Because if you spin the clock back to the time when the film Mo and Me was made, high definition video was a new phenomenon. And initially, there was a lot of debate within the film community. How do we treat archival material in an HD world? So in the film Mo and Me, the archival material from the famine in Ethiopia, 1984. That material was reformatted for a 16x9 screen. Today, we probably would never do that. And that's just within a 10-year period. So part of it has been looking at Mo's work and saying, how do we technically bring it into this world but retain the integrity of those images? And it's especially important with Mo's work because he was able to document so many iconic stories. So the one that many people will remember is the song We Are the World and how that became an anthem that helped save millions of lives in Ethiopia. But Mo's work was the impetus to that song. Without Mo Amin's photography in Tigray province in Ethiopia in 1984-85, there would not have been a Live Aid. There would not have been a We Are the World because the world didn't know that that famine was taking place. So now when we revisit those images years later, we're still looking at, okay, how do we treat them? How much do we restore? 3/4 inch and early beta from that era doesn't look good anymore, but that's the
Our
story.
Our eyes have changed, yeah.
Yeah, that's the story. You know, even the pacing of documentaries today has changed dramatically. But I think that's part of the art form that Salim and I have both embraced when we look at Mohamed Amin's work is maintaining that integrity and then, in a filmic sense, exploiting it for the narrative that we're telling today. So if, for example, we're doing work around the We Are the World song, how do we make sure that his work is left intact and has the integrity in which it was brought to the world in the first place?
It still serves the story now.
And it is completely, it has all the emotional quality today that it had then. When you see the images of women and children starving in Ethiopia in 1984, it's gut-wrenching to look at. And it was gut-wrenching for him to film it, but he had the courage and he had the logistic skills and the management skills and the personality to be the one who went in and got that footage. And that's why his story is so extraordinary to me.
Well, I cannot wait to see this exhibition. I wish both of you the best of luck in taking this further. And I hope when the next phase happens, you'll come back in and talk to me again.
I hope so. And I hope we'll have it in Milwaukee again.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Chip Duncan is a Milwaukee-based photojournalist and filmmaker. Salim Amin is a Nairobi-based journalist and documentary maker and the son of photojournalist Mohamed Amin.
An exhibit of Mohamed Amin's and Chip Duncan's work called Inspiring Change is on display at the Charles Alice Museum through mid-October. You can see some of the images from the exhibit at WUWM.com.
One last break, then the latest episode of Exfabula, when Lake Effect Weekend returns on WUWM.
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Exfabula!
True personal stories.
Exfabula!
Exfabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
And it's Exfabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. Glad to have you with us. I'm Rachel Owens, joined again by Exfabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Welcome.
Oh, hello again. Thanks so much for having me. Today we have a very important theme. The theme is, it's up to us, talking to kids about race. We have some really great poignant stories revolving around this. And the reason being is that in the subsequent 50 years since the open housing marches, it's pretty evident that the stories and lessons from those marches have largely disappeared from our public consciousness. And, you know, I could actually give you a moment. Last week on Thursday morning, I was watching national news, and they brought up the news point of the Sterling Brown video being released. They also started talking about the Sherman Park and the Dontre Hamilton and all of the issues that have gone on in the past few years in Milwaukee was the script for that news piece. And it occurs to me, and I'm sure it occurs to a lot of people, that this has got to change. The first step to doing so is to talking to kids about race. So you as parents and we as adults and guardians can be proactive agents of change by changing the script right now. And so I would like to roll into our first story from one of our fellowship events, Talking to Kids About Race, which happened in May. Here is Zach Heimerl with his story.
Several years ago, when my son Ethan was 7 years old, I brought him to spend the weekend at his grandparents' house, something we'd done many times before without incident. This time, though, shortly after I dropped him off on my way home, I got a phone call from Grandpa. I picked it up expecting to hear Grandpa's voice on the other side of the phone, but it wasn't Grandpa this time. It was my 7-year-old son, Ethan, sobbing. He was inconsolable. I couldn't understand a single thing that he was saying between his sobbing breaths. I thought something horrible had happened. I thought maybe Grandpa had died. What could make my son so upset? So I calmed him down best I could, slowed him down, got him to breathe. And I found out, luckily, it wasn't Grandpa. Nothing had happened to Grandpa. But when I heard what had happened, it made me wonder, had I failed my son as a father? Did I appropriately set him up to deal with a moment like this? Or had I sheltered him? Had I protected him too much? See, we'd always raised my son to be open, kind, and accepting to people of all types. But also, we raised him in a suburban community, somewhat isolated. He lived a pretty privileged life. For example, his exposure to the N-word was only incidental, if that, up to this point, which is why this moment was so difficult for him. Once I got him to calm down, I learned that across the street from Grandpa's house is a bus stop. And from the front yard, he had witnessed an incident where a white woman had berated a older African-American man, calling him the N-word repeatedly, shouting all sorts of obscenities at him repeatedly. And it just destroyed my son, Ethan. He didn't know how to deal with it. He had never been exposed to such hatred up to this point. So when he came home from Grandpa's, his mother and I, we sat down. We had a conversation with him about this incident. We explained how, you know, this woman was hateful. This woman was in the wrong. This word, the N-word, it's a horrible word. It's a naughty word. You never want to use this word to describe anybody, especially not somebody who's African American. But you know, he was 7 years old. We didn't go much deeper than that. We said, this woman is hateful. This word is naughty. We're not to use it. And we were able to move on fairly smoothly from that point without incident until a few days later, I got another phone call, this time from his school. Shortly after this phone call, I received an email with the subject line, the N-word at Lincoln Elementary. We were mortified. What had happened was Ethan had told this story of this incident at his grandpa's house to another kid in his class. And in telling this story, he explained what the N-word was, and he explained that it's a naughty word and that you're not to tell it. And his friend also happened to be white and also happened to never heard this word before. And just like, you know, any second grader, any 7-year-old who learned a new naughty word, he did what many of them might, and he started chanting this word over and over and over again in class. And it just so happened that there was another boy in earshot who was African American. It's important to note that this school is about 88% white, about 4% black. The entire staff is white, and they're not used to dealing with these types of situations at all. And they dealt with it the best that they could. They removed the boys, the offenders, and dealt with them appropriately, called their parents. They also contacted the boy who had overheard the situation and alerted her. And this was the woman who had sent me that email. And it's also important to note that this community is very tight-knit. Everybody knows everybody else, and this type of news would spread quickly. And immediately, us parents, we wanted to save face. We wanted to make this right because we're not those kind of parents, right? We're not this kind of family. So we sent out an email, oh my gosh, we're so mortified. We're so sorry that this happened. You know, this is not the type of, you know, family that we are, and so on and so forth. And we cooperated with the school, and we agreed with any type of punishment that they saw fit. And so Ethan and the chanter, they lost a full week of recess. They had to issue an apology to the boy who was nearby. But what didn't happen was we didn't have a discussion. We didn't talk about how this made the other boy feel. We didn't talk about the N-word. And in our attempt to save face, in our attempt to not be seen as that kind of family, we were all too happy to just sort of let this pass and to move on quietly. But looking back now, 7 years later, I wonder, in my attempt not to be that kind of family, did we help perpetuate the very things we were trying to avoid? I don't know.
And that was Zach Heimerl with his story in regards to talking to kids about race.
Very powerful story, and the reflection at the end, even though I'm someone who wanted to make this change, did I affect that change or did I make the problem worse? It's a very deep question.
Yeah, and just being conscious of it in the first place, that is the first step. And the great things about these fellowship events that we offer is we open up a door of opportunity for people to come in that might be grappling with these same questions to help them sort out some answers or some tools to deal with that. We do have a couple of fellowship events coming up. The next one's going to be on May 31st, and it's a Fellows and Facilitators Milwaukee Monumental. And the theme is like, what's the story that we tell about ourselves? How does a city choose to remember its past? So we're going to have a storytelling and dialogue, beginning with an introduction with our friend, Dasha Kelly of Stillwaters Collective. And we're going to feature true personal stories from Exfabula Fellows, followed by small group dialogue discussions at the Zeidler Center facilitators. So this is going to be an important one. We also have a June 1st Fellowship Nonprofits Race and Inclusion event that's coming up too. All of those events could be found on exfabula.org. But before I leave you, let's have one more story. This one is from Liza Kessler, who told her story at our Power, Dissent, and Youth Empowerment with the Milwaukee Art Museum in September.
You don't look like a very agitated audience. When I came and saw that piece in the Rashid Johnson exhibit, it really changed the way I think about driving around Milwaukee. I drive around the city a lot in my work. And one of the things that I am responsible for is looking at houses that have been sold or where permits have been issued on a place in the city of Milwaukee. And one of my neighborhoods is around like 13th and Ring, like Burleigh, Ring, Concordia, just to the west of where the interstate comes through. And I get a lot of permits that are called raise and erosion control. And what that means is that once upon a time, there was a house there that people lived in. And that house decayed so far that it was unsafe and condemned and broken down and raised. And then they put some grass seed down so that all the dirt wouldn't run into the sidewalk. Those people are missing, like the faces are missing. And around that neighborhood, there are heartbreaking blocks. I mean, you can walk down a block and there might be a whole block where there's no missing houses. And then the next block, there might be five missing houses. And then in the next block, there's two or three missing houses. Or you might walk down the block and there's one house in the middle of the block and it looks so strange. And all those people are missing. And we know where they are, right? We know we have a mass incarceration problem. We know what we have done with those people. But it breaks your heart driving around and seeing the evidence. Those people aren't missing equally all over the city of Milwaukee. I mean, I don't need to tell you that. But when I drive around other neighborhoods in the city of Milwaukee, there's a lot fewer raise and erosion control. So I have a daughter who turned 9 last week, and she asked me this summer, what's the hood? And we were getting ready to go to take her to camp, and I wasn't expecting the question. I was trying to get everybody's shoes on and get out of the house, and I was kind of thrown. Then she said, is Sherman Park the hood? And that was such a weird moment for me because I'm 48. I grew up in the city of Milwaukee. I didn't grow up in Sherman Park, but most of my friends did. I mean, other than the neighborhood where I actually lived, that was the neighborhood in Milwaukee I knew the best and where I spent the most time. And I had to try to figure out, how am I going to even tell her what hood means? So I kind of flailed at an answer for that, which was sort of its unkind word for neighborhood. It's sort of a short form, but it's sort of insulting. And When people use it, they're usually not saying something nice about the place they're talking about. And please get your shoes on because I got to go to work. But I kept thinking about it because if I don't answer these questions, if I don't tell her about why some neighborhoods are the way they are, as she grows up and starts to learn how much money does it take to live in a nice house or a nice apartment, and how much money do you earn in a good job, how much money do you earn in a lousy job, she's going to think that these are choices that people are making and that people want to live in a neighborhood where houses are decaying and so dangerous that they have to be raised with erosion control. So I circled back with her after I saw the exhibit and said, we need to talk a little bit about history for me to be able to answer that question. Because it used to be that real estate agents drew red lines around maps in the city of Milwaukee. And if you were white, you could live over here. But if you were black, you couldn't live over here. You had to live over there. And then there were also a lot of factories in the city of Milwaukee. And they were pretty good jobs for a long time that people could raise their families on. But a lot of those factories shut down because it turned out that it was cheaper to pay people in China. And when they shut those down, a lot of the white people moved out to the suburbs and a lot of the black people couldn't. And they didn't have those kinds of jobs anymore, so they didn't have the money to put in their houses. And the houses started to decay and a lot of them started to fall apart. And a lot of those people didn't feel like they had very many choices. And I hope I'm raising her to be an agitated audience.
And that was Lizza Kessler's story.
Another powerful one as well. And as you said, these are discussions that always need to happen. They're ongoing. So it's great to hear these at a very poignant time, it feels like.
Yeah. Everybody, be proactive and conscious about these issues. This is the only way we're going to be able to push through them and start a new script for Milwaukee.
Feels like a good way to kind of transition into season 10 as well.
Yes, we did finish our Story Slams of the season, and I want to give a big thank you to all of our sponsors, including Northwestern Mutual, who is our season 9 spotlight sponsor. It's really important to have these season sponsors. These sponsors help us with programs like Equal Access and our fellowship and other community events that we could use help with. All of that information can be found at info.exfabula.org, and then all storytelling, story-related pieces about us and who we are can be found at exfabula.org.
Well, thanks again for coming in, Leah. It's been another great week.
Yes, thank you so much. Have a great Memorial Day weekend.
You as well.
Exfabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up another edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned now for All Things Considered. It's coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.